back to the show, Arash. It's great to have you back. You were just here like a month ago, but people should know that I have been bugging Arash to do this for about a year and a half. This was my original goal. So today is a big victory for me today, is that I finally have Arash here to talk about the meaning of missiles. That's going to be the name of this episode. It's not the greatest title, but that's kind of going to be what we're exploring. But Arash, you're here in this different capacity. You were last year to talk about the Iran-China deal, and we kind of dissected that from political analysting. But now you're wearing a different hat today. This is a kind of, I guess, a long-term interest of yours, hobby. I don't know. Like you got into this stuff a while ago.
Well, yeah, it's a long story, but to make things brief, I did political science as my bachelor's degree, and then, you know, pretty much I was interested in the idea of hegemony. And hegemony is defined in three components, you know, the military, the political, and the economic. And during my master's degree, I did do a, you know, master's degree in economics and Middle Eastern studies, political economy. So I kind of covered the political and economic sphere, and then I tried to do a third master's degree in military science. Yeah, in the midst of all that, you know, the third degree, I thought to myself, it's time to just quit college. I've had just about enough of school and studies, and I basically turned it into a minor. So, you know, I was interested in this idea of hegemony during my studies, you know, theoretically about what constitutes a superpower. And part of that is the military component and the military supremacy it has. So I learned a lot about, you know, during my studies about the, you know, the early development of warfare and the strategic, you know, components of warfare, low intensity conflict, stuff like that. And that's pretty much how I ended up doing the vlog. And, you know, during my regular working hours, I'm a political advisor. You know, I advise governors at a strategic level. So I do try to stay in touch with this idea of hegemony in every way I can. You know, I can do the vlog. I haven't done it for a while, but, you know, definitely trying to get back to it. But that's pretty much my my interest. And of course, as someone from the region who is almost on a daily basis bombarded with subjects like these, you just got to know a little bit about everything just to keep things normal and you know, comprehensible.
So Arash, yes, this you did use the word bombard, which sadly is a very relevant term today, because as we're speaking, there's essentially a war going on. Not essentially, there is a war going on. We're seeing right now the something we haven't seen in decades, and definitely not from the Palestinian side in terms of like the global conflict. We haven't seen this kind of war in many, many years. And from the Palestinian side, we haven't seen these kind of capabilities, which have dramatically scale of the violence, at least on the Israeli side for them. Historically, they've been able to sort of avoid major casualties, but we can get into all of that. But essentially something different is going on in this current round of fighting. So maybe we can kind of take this apart, because one of the things that keeps getting sort of hyped by, you know, mostly people who are anti-Iran normies, is the secret hidden rule of Iran behind this, specifically missile technology, the rocketry technology that the Palestinian resistance groups are using right now. Iran is said to be the sort of master figure, the puppet master, right? So I wanted to kind of jump into this episode with you today to kind of explore the meaning of all of this and think about how missiles and rocketry have sort of altered the calculations for not just sort of asymmetric warfare, which is what this is, right? Because Palestinians don't have an army, they don't have military, they don't have like a formal, they have to fight using sort of guerrilla tactics. But what we're seeing now is definitely different than what we've seen in previous intifadas in terms of like street, there's no street-to-street combat yet. I mean, there was a little bit in the West Bank yesterday. But this has been mostly something done from afar, right? This has been the rockets and the missiles that are currently being used by the resistance have changed the calculus for the Israeli side. I don't think we can sort of go back to the status quo after all this. But I wanted to bring you on today to sort of have a basic explanation of maybe a kind of intro to the history of rocketry, the history of missiles. And specifically, then kind of go into the Iranian case study of how it's pursued a defensive missile program that has now morphed into a strategic missile program in terms of arranging its alliance and a range of how it connects with its with the sort of resistance axis. That was a big sort of messy way of basically saying, like, let's talk today about the role of missile technology and the sort of changing status quo. But so just at the outset, maybe we can kind of give people a understanding of missiles, rockets, kind of it's a long history. Yeah. It goes back to the Middle Ages, but maybe we can kind of begin with that and sort of move from there.
Yeah, I think we can talk about modern missile technology development, but I think we need to make the distinction because there is somewhat of a confusion between, you know, what constitutes a rocket, what constitutes a missile. I guess we should start with, you know, clearly defining what the differences are, just to give some insights. You know, missile is somewhat different to a conventional rocket, right? A missile would be a military rocket, so it is a rocket, but it's a weapon, and it has an automated control system to find targets. It could also be a weapon that is used to remotely adjust to the intended target, but it's typically, a missile is very military oriented, whereas the rocket, it's an aerospace vehicle essentially, and you can use a rocket as a satellite launcher. You can use a rocket for weather research, for missiles, and, you know, ballistic missiles. So that's the difference. You know, the rocket is a multi-purpose technology, whereas the missile is much more oriented towards military objectives, long range objectives. You know, things that require very long ranges are typically missiles. That's the main difference, right? So to launch a missile, you need to know a lot of different things, you know, about the aerodynamic characteristics like lift and drag, and how to facilitate the movement, taking into account weather. And these characteristics greatly affect, you know, the altitude, the distance, and it also determines the speed, the Mach value. And missiles need to have a certain flying or cruise height, right, where, you know, they have to avoid radar detection. So they have to flow be launched and in the atmosphere, or at least in the air, as low as possible to avoid, you know, radar detection. And at the same time, it can't afford to lose lift. So in that case, you know, there are two very different things. A missile is typically typified as something to have a military component, whereby, you know, you have an intended target and you can automatically adjust it, or you can adjust it remotely. That's pretty much the difference. And in terms of rocket, I mean, rockets, like you told me, and like you've said before, you know, fireworks makers and, you know, the ancient world has been familiar to some extent with prototypes of rockets, right? The Song Dynasty in the 900s, who had the precursor of black powder, or gunpowder. The precursor of the gunpowder was black powder. And, you know, slowly you see that, you know, from the 900s onwards, that rockets aren't really that potent anymore. They're not as useful, they're not as accurate, and they get overtaken by other forms of artillery. So that's what leaves us pretty much in a big hole in terms of much of the Middle Ages and then later on, up until the interbellum period, right? The war between the World War I, World War II period. That's when really you start seeing a renewed insights into rocket capabilities, and also looking at not only rockets as a launching pad, for example, for, you know, space travel, but also in terms of its military dimension, you know, the missiles. And, you know, the Germans during the Nazi period had a lot to do with that. The Soviets, of course, had a lot to do with that. But I think during, you know, Germany under the Third Reich is where you see this renewed interest of rockets as a military capability, you know, this renewed interest. And it started with, you know, the development of the A1 and the A2, which became missiles. So that's when we talk about missiles, when the Nazis developed and started funding had a lot of interest in developing capabilities that would reach into other European cities. And of course, this culminated into the V1, one of the earliest ballistic missiles used in combat. The V1 was a very famous bomber. It was called the Buzz Bomb. It would fly around European cities in London and in various major cities in Europe on behalf of the Nazis, and it would make a buzzing sound. It was a very potent weapon, would scare off a lot of people, and created the fear amongst the general population. And also it became very obvious that the Europeans, you know, in terms of the Allies, were at a disadvantage to the Nazis. Once they realized this rocket, this military component of the rocket in terms of a missile, became something that was much more prominent in warfare. So slowly you see the Allies adjusting to this reality. Right, and the Soviets saw this very early on. They tried to copy a lot of the German technology, and slowly the Allies also tried to get in pace with that development. But of course, like I said, the military component is one part. You know, before the Third Reich discovered missiles, you had an increased interest in rocket capabilities. You know, in terms of space travel, you know, there were a lot of mathematicians, a lot of engineers. Who are interested in using rocket technology to reach the stars. But we're really talking about World War II when we refer to missile technology and the way that missiles have been used. And of course, then you had the interwoven nature of the science community and the military community, whereby, you know, you have the space race, for example. By the mid-1950s, the United States and the Soviet Union were entangled in the space race, where rockets became very important. And eventually, you know, you also had the nuclear arms race between the Soviet Union and the United States in the 1960s. So there's multiple dimensions to this idea of a rocket. You know, you can use it for military dimensions, for space travel, for, you know, to travel outside of Earth's orbit. But in the 1960s, you slowly see the development of missiles really being used as a missile capability, and what is called a revolution in military affairs. Revolution of military affairs refers to the interwoven relation between the scientific community and the military community coming together, you know, the way we see today, Silicon Valley and the, you know, military industrial complex, you know, Eisenhower up to Kennedy with the, you know, the Cuban Missile Crisis. You really see the hasting after World War II, trying to understand what the Nazis were doing, using many scientists, integrating them with the military establishment, and creating this semi-scientific endeavor, and at the same time using it for military purposes. So when we talk about this military revolution, right, RMA is what it's called, the Revolution in Military Affairs, you talk about the total scientific technical progress of the sector. And you know, it's not just a tank revolution. It's not just an airplane revolution. You're talking about, you know, the IT sector becoming an integrated part of the military industrial complex. That's where we're going from World War II up to the Cuban Missile Crisis, the space race. And today, you know, these things are becoming much more prominent. You know, this interwoven idea of IT being commenced, you know, being integrated in this military sector. And we saw this during the first Gulf War, maybe more than anything. That's when you really saw the fruits of this revolution of military affairs. You know, during the first Gulf War, when the United States tried to save Kuwait with Saddam Hussein invading Kuwait, the United States making it very clear that an occupation of Kuwait was not acceptable, it started using, you know, a lot of the radioelectric equipment, a lot of the automated control systems, a lot of the so-called precision-guided munitions, a lot of the warfare that we see today were utilized for the first time at a grand scale during the first Gulf War. That's really when you see a lot of the sophistication, the tracking technology, the stealth technology being utilized against a hostile state, and then afterwards being rolled out, of course, in the Iraq War, the Afghanistan War, various other wars that the United States took place in. But this is the general overarching terminology that's used. And for Iran and many other countries in the region, you know, like I mentioned, you know, the first Gulf War, I think that was the main event whereby other countries in the region really started realizing, well, you know what, this is going into a certain direction and we need to respond to this hegemony. You know, so the hegemonic superpowers have developed and commenced certain strategies in order to fight off one another. You know, you have the Soviet Union and the United States after World War II being the preeminent powers of the world, creating all this technology. And suddenly the United States is now the slowly becoming more and more powerful, right? You see slowly during the 1980s, 1970s, 1980s, you know, 2000s, that the United States just keeps on becoming a single unipolar power throughout the world and utilizing a lot of the technologies on these countries. And that's where you see that other countries in the region, in West Asia, are, you know, have to appropriately calculate their responses. So in Iran's case, that would mean, you know, a very calculated response. It's not something that is necessarily done by Iran in a vacuum, of course. Iran takes into account all of these developments that have taken place. You know, the space race, the arms race, the Cold War between the Soviet Iran is, you know, after the Islamic Revolution, it really had to recalculate. Okay, so we were an export market for the United States for goods and services, for a lot of the tanks, a lot of the rockets, a lot of the missiles that we bought, but we had no knowledge of them. You know, we bought the F-14. We're the only country that had the F-14 Tomcat. But we didn't know how to overhaul it, or how to technically improve it, or to repair it. All these things were done by American servicemen who were stationed in Iran. And suddenly you have this revolution in 1979 in Iran, where all of these servicemen, all of these mechanics leave, and the United States starts becoming a belligerent party supporting Iraq with chemical agents. And suddenly, you know, you're empty-handed. And that's really where you see the Iranian context developing, right? The consciousness of Iran's new elite, many of them from middle-class, poor backgrounds who are becoming more and more prominently available. Many of the Bazaari children are becoming more prominent, are trying to figure out ways to survive, keep this revolution alive despite the odds. And, you know, this is the context they have to work with, essentially.
Right. So it's kind of hard to sort of encompass all of this, but essentially I think what sort of key thing to think about our moment is that we are watching right now, like live, something unfolding that's been, I don't know, that's been kind of growing for some decades now, which is a realignment of strategic power in West Asia. And also just in terms of the relationship to the monopolar or sort of monopolar world where the U.S. has achieved what it calls or what it presumes to call what it presumes to be full spectrum dominance, right? Like that, mm-hmm. The fact that the first Gulf War was a kind of showcase war where they got to, like in German, you say Schaufenster, sort of display window. That was kind of like, here yes. is what war will look like from now on. And there was a kind of truth to it, obviously. However, like the sort of American assumptions, right? The assumptions we made because of the media. I mean, I remember it back then. I remember I was barely 10 years old, but I remember the kind of, it was like Samuel Huntington embodied, right? It was like this, oh, we have achieved the end of history, and we are watching this little feeble, resistant rogue nation crumble under our boot, right? And we get to film it live. We get to release the footage. We get to see that grainy footage of the crosshairs, right? And so there is this sort of spectacular dimension to modern warfare that missile technology and missiles themselves are kind of responding, are kind of part of, right? It's a kind of theatrical performance of power, whereby it's not like you don't have, like, we think of war as tanks, soldiers, aircraft carriers, fighter jets, but like, and this is key, a missile is very cheap. A missile is a cheap thing, and it can be mass produced, and it can be produced fairly easily, fairly simply. You don't have to have a massive capital outflow. You don't need to have like a huge industrial sort of complex. Like, it's not, the joke is it's not rocket science, right? Like, it actually, like that, in terms of military in terms of military power, missiles have achieved something that, at least in the case of Iran, and we should also get to other sort of rogue nations, so-called rogue nations, like North Korea, they've achieved a massive deterrent power that would have been otherwise unimaginable for a country like Iran, for a country like North Korea. So let's get into, and these two countries are actually related, and their interrelated histories of military or missile power are actually very, very closely related, as we'll probably get into. So maybe we can think about the Iranian, can we jump into the Iranian case study? Because it is a sort of, it is a very instructive of what power could mean, like, and frankly, why hasn't the U.S. invaded us by now? Like, if they could, they would have by now. So missiles are a big reason for that. I have this friend who actually, first episode of the podcast, Eskander, he told me once, like, we were kind of having an argument about something. We were talking about, you know, the representation of Iran in the sort of public sphere or whatever. And I was making something and he's like, listen, it doesn't matter. Iran has missiles. And like every time, and every time I think about a kind of argument, like I sort of go back to him, it's like thinking about in terms of hard power versus representation of power. I always think about that line, Iran has missiles, whereby there is a kind of truth factor to them of establishing a certain reality, which is if you do something to our country, if you wage a war in our country, we can inflict massive damage upon you very quickly and very easily by literally pushing some buttons, right? Like that's a radical transformation of geopolitics that like we should kind of sort of think about. And that's what we're watching right now in Palestine. I mean, that to me is just mind blowing.
Yeah, it's mind blowing how, you know, this cheap technology, relatively cheap technology compared to this full spectrum dominance you spoke of earlier, has the potency to completely undermine a hegemonic superpower. And I think for Iran's case, of course, I mean, look, Iran has had numerous contexts that it had to deal with, you know, the defeats of the, you know, the, what is called the Arab-Israeli War, and the defeat of Nasserism as, you know, a potent model for many Arabs to follow. The decline thereof, and you know the role of the United States of coming into the region, you know, basically replacing the United Kingdom in the 1970s. You know, a lot of these contexts have to do with how Iran positioned itself, and also how it's dealing with other allies in the region. And you know, this seeps through. You know, they have a lot of interwoven interests, a lot of interwoven histories, and a lot of rationale is, you know, overlaps. And I think it's important to go back, like you said, you know. Iran had a revolution. It was mainly a state that was buying, a rentier economy, buying military hardware from the United States, from the Europeans to a certain degree. And then suddenly it becomes empty-handed. It has no capabilities. The United States starts supporting Saddam Hussein. The Europeans start supporting Saddam Hussein. And in their war against Iran, and Iran is suddenly confronted with all these different countries, all these superpowers, you know, armed to the teeth with nuclear warheads. And it's thinking, what can we do? How can we, you know, make this, allow this revolution to survive? And a lot of it had to do with the airplanes and the aircraft that the United States and the Europeans, the French in particular, were providing to Saddam Hussein. Because the weaponry that was being provided to Saddam Hussein outside of just the biological and chemical warfare that it was he was using against Iranians, you know, related to artillery rockets, it related to ballistic missiles, it related to aircraft. These were all very advanced compared to the Iranian case. Iran had a very limited inventory, limited knowledge, didn't have the skill set or the manpower to really, create a counterweight to that. So when Iraq... and this was, of course, during the 1980s, invaded Iran. Iran was invaded. But in 2 years into the war, Iran managed to gain the upper hand. It basically, 2 years after the war in 1982, Iran was already fighting Iraq on Iraqi soil. So it managed to push back the Iraqi invasion, despite all the support it had from the United States, despite all the aircraft, and fight on Iraqi soil. The problem, of course, was that Saddam Hussein started using chemical and biological weapons. And what they also did, the Iraqis, was to utilize aircraft and helicopters, Bell helicopters, Super Etendard aircraft jets, who were then equipped with bombs, and they were flying over to major Iranian cities and bombing them. And that became the major reason, especially the air supremacy, for Iran to, you know, completely recalculate the way it was dealing with Iraq, because suddenly you had an attack on major populated cities in Iran, and Iraq is becoming desperate at this point. You know, Iran is 2 years into the war, Iran gains the upper hand, it's becoming desperate. Around 1984, it realizes it can no longer win the war, it can no longer fight on Iranian soil. So it begins using a lot of the technology, the air supremacy that the West is giving Iraq. That's when Iran starts realizing, okay, we need to assemble a missile force. We can't win from them in terms of air superiority. The Soviet Union is not supporting us. The Europeans are not supporting us. The United States is not supporting us. We have limited aircraft capabilities. How can we offset this supremacy in terms of air superiority, right? Air superiority is the major threat. It's creating a lot of fear. It's creating a lot of instability in Iran, and it needs to be stopped. So this is basically when Iran starts assembling a tiny missile force, a Scud force to be exact. The Syrians helped train Iranians. And that was a very important point. You know, the father of the current president, Assad, Hafez al-Assad, really supported the Iranian Scud development program. Iran also lobbied in Libya with Colonel Gaddafi to get Scud missiles in order to reciprocate the attacks by air from Iraq. Gaddafi, of course, first promised Scud missiles, even delivered them to Iran, and then declined authorization to fire them. So that was a major setback. But the North Koreans, together with the Syrians, really helped Iran to create the foundations of Iran's modern missile industry. Iranian delegation, especially under the leadership of Hassan Tehrani Moghaddam, one of the founders of Iran's missile program, he went to North Korea. He spoke with Hafez al-Assad. And, you know, you see this coordination going on where they are not only delivering the weapons, the Scud missiles and the Hwasong missiles from North Korea, they're also giving us technical knowledge. And this was crucial, right? These are two countries that have a lot of have a lot to lose, but at the same time see an opportunity in becoming one of the few countries that are helping Iran and will therefore play a very important role in the future of how Iran conducts its foreign affairs and how it conducts its affairs with those countries. Of course, Iran will reciprocate with what is happening with the Syrian war years later. But you know, these two countries were very important. Gaddafi had a very controversial idea about, you know, first he was very passionate about delivering the Scuds. Later on, he declined and he said, we can't afford to, you know, be seen attacking our Arab brothers with our missiles. But this basically formed the foundation. You know, you want to offset the War of the Cities, if you will. That's what it was called, the War of the Cities. You want to stop the aerial strikes. You want to respond with strikes in Iraqi cities, of course, against military targets, because that was the preferred target for Iran. You know, so you look at Kirkuk, you look at certain areas of Baghdad, you look at certain areas of Basra, and that's when you have the realization in Iran. You know, once these missiles or the Scuds become operational, they are actually launched. You see that the Iraqis the Iraqis are responding, they're calculating their counterstrikes. So the Iranians realize that, you know, sure, the Iraqis are attacking by aircraft, but once you reciprocate that attack with a missile strike, that's when you see a decline of aerial strikes by Iraq. So it correlates. So, you know, the Iranians start realizing this correlates. These attacks and these counterstrikes are actually correlated. And that military, this is the real important, you know, conclusion, that missiles can offset aerial superiority. That was the major important conclusion that was made during that period. And that another important point, of course, especially taking away from the period of the monarchy, was that missiles need to be produced domestically with domestic knowledge, domestic skilled Iranians. You cannot determine any, you know, you can't depend on any other party. Sure, the North Koreans were there, the Syrians were there, but we have to move onwards. So the Iran-Iraq war becomes this microcosm of a larger global war theater, right, in international relations, whereby Iran sees threats and opportunities, albeit in a larger scale, right? So Iran still has those enemies with vastly superior aerial capabilities, but on a much larger scale, right? And it, to this day, it is still functioning in that way. And to this day, it's looking towards its missile program as an opportunity to offset not just the air superiority, but various types of attacks. Iran calculates that there's basically two intentions or two goals that are achieved with using this missile technology. On the one hand, you signal at the forefront to your enemies that, look, if you attack us, then we're going to reciprocate that attack. We're going to counterattack you. And so missiles are used as a deterring factor, right? Before they even think of initiating attack, Iran will offer an immediate counterstrike and a prolonged missile attack, which is going to strike terror in the eyes of the population, is going to create a lot of havoc, is going to succumb your economy. So make sure that you understand the benefits don't always outweigh the liabilities. It's a major warning capability. It's something that Hezbollah, for example, in Lebanon also utilizes very closely, looking back at the situation that Iran has been in. A second way of signaling is when the war is already taking place, you know, like we see today in Gaza, and you know, during the 2006 war, the enemy decides to actual attack, just like in the Iran-Iraq war, the enemy is already attacked, and is using its air supremacy, is using various means of attacking the civilian population. But by doing that, it's also, you know, you're also creating, and by firing these weapons, you're basically creating a situation whereby they have to consider a ceasefire. You're imposing a situation whereby they have to consider a ceasefire, considering the fact that you can reciprocate these attacks. So one is proactive, the other is more reactive, in that you have, you know, you're already in the war intra-war period, where you're trying to commence an intra-war deterrence capability. And this is, you know, the second part is something that Ansar Allah is also very much in Yemen is also very much working with. Saudis are invading and attacking with the so-called coalition forces Yemeni sovereign territory. Ansar Allah develops a very sophisticated group of weapons and capabilities, and by attacking by means of cruise missiles, by means of medium range missiles and rockets, by attacking the enemy, it's already in the phase of war, but it's creating a deterrent situation whereby the Saudis have to calculate whether they actually want to go into a war or not. And a war is never really won in terms of, a lot of people are wondering, what is the definition of winning a war? How do we constitute a win? And, at this point, if you continue to barrage an enemy with rockets and missiles and hit directly their major and vital infrastructure, create terror, succumb their economy to, fears and shocks, that's not a win for you. It doesn't matter if you have nuclear weapons. It doesn't matter if you have the best army in the world, the best infantry in the world. If you cannot stop your enemy from firing at you, you haven't won the war. And that's what we're currently seeing in Gaza. That's what we're seeing in countries like Yemen. That's what we're seeing in all these different countries that have aligned themselves in an integrated approach, right? This is not something of a puppet master that you've discussed earlier, Sina, where Iran is deciding the stakes. No, Iran has an interest to give these countries, just like Syria, just like North Korea did Iran, give them the necessary knowledge, the skill set, maybe even some of the components required to start their own indigenous production, their own knowledge base of creating these weapons as a deterrence factor and as a defense capability. And that's what you see unfolding in various countries in this region. We are seeing the early developments, right? And if you look at, for example, a lot of the Palestinian territories, if you look at Hezbollah, for example, today in Lebanon, they have reached Scud knowledge right now. So they're basically at the phase where they're in the 1970s and 80s of Iran. And Iran, I think, is really counting. A lot of people are saying, so why doesn't Iran deliver, these... cruise missiles to Hezbollah. That's something you don't want to do. You want them to learn by doing. You want indigenous Lebanese people, people in Gaza, people in Yemen, to learn, to have a skilled set of professionals who know what they're doing, who do not rely on anyone else, and who have the potency to defend their people against what is, very much regarded as a U.S. aggression against their country, in some form or another.
Right. So, in a sense, like, missiles are a kind of equalizer. They collapse the distance between you and the enemy. Think about if you kind of push the thinking, like, okay, let's say US wants to wage a war on Iran. Okay. Like, they would need like months of logistics to just even think about it. Like that kind of massive, moving into a massive country like Iran and doing, say, what they did in Iraq, right? That would be a massive undertaking that would take so much time. Right. So it makes you ask yourself, like, first of all, like, would Iran ever allow that? No. And how would they not allow that? Well, they have these missiles, aside from all the sort of conventional military things. So that's the kind of framework around this, which of course makes you ask, well, have they neutralized the threat of war with these missiles? I think yes. Now, whatever, we can speculate what the meaning of that is, but since the development of the Iranian program, and then the related to that, all these kind of rogue nations that have adopted this kind of, I don't want to be corny about it, but it's almost like, I was just thinking about it. It's the, who's the character who steals fire? God, I forget now. Oh my God, where's my humanity's brain? The character who steals fire to give it to the mortals. It was, oh no, I have to Google it. Sorry, this is like a very guy who stole the fire. The fire. Prometheus.
Prometheus.
This is a kind of like Promethean thing, right? In the sense that you give this technology to your allies or people who are enemies of your enemy. And as a kind of protection, they develop it, they turn it into something. And all of a sudden, what we think of as conventional power, right? Tanks, ships, planes, right? Suddenly you have to sort of change that view because, like, you know, you look at the speed of certain missiles and then you look at the speed of like an aircraft carrier. And then I plug it through my supercomputer of a brain and I say, what does it mean to have an aircraft carrier today when you can just lob some missiles at it? Like, is it, have they?
Absolutely.
Like, isn't kind of conventional military power kind of meaningless in a sense?
In
a situation like countries like Iran in, I mean, it has changed the, and then people always jump to the nuclear question, right? Like, so DPRK, which we should probably talk about because as your video, I recommend it on your blog. This is, as you explain it, right? Like they did have this kind of close working connection and also sort of ideological, philosophical connection, which helped blossom or sort of, helped Iranians sort of develop that missile program that's so important now to the strategic thinking of the country.
You make a good point. Just to go back to the revolution in military affairs, right? So we talked about the scientific technical integration. In the Soviet Union and in the United States, this revolution of military affairs started after World War II, right? And a lot of the thinking evolving around RMA is focused on, okay, so you can't win a war with holding a gun, right? Holding a gun and, you know, the man with the gun is no longer offering the decisive victories. And today, you know, RMA, even from that period, you know, you're talking about the post-war period, they said, so it's not the guy with the gun, it's the guy with the nuclear weapons. And that's what caused a lot of the arms race, right? So they think nuclear weapons is going to secure them not only a position of supremacy, but also the means of, you know, winning a decisive victory, of having this full spectrum domination over, you know, the battlefield. What Iran has done and what, you know, a lot of the post, you know, the decolonial resistance movements have done, you know, many of them supported by the Soviet Union, was to invoke this idea of asymmetrical warfare, whereby, look, you don't want to put your eggs all in one basket. You know, even Iran, you know, has missiles, but you have to look at the total battlefield. You know, you have to look at infantry. What did Iran do after the revolution in 1979? It recruited as many people as possible in the Basij. So this is not the conventional military force of Iran, but you want as many people to know how to fire a gun on the battlefield as possible. And if I'm not mistaken, around 1 in 7 or 1 in 6 Iranians has military training. That's a huge amount of people. It's a huge lot of volunteers that are ready and combat ready, in any case, to a certain degree. And so you're talking about, you know, when we talk about, you know, the Zionist regime trying to infiltrate into Gaza, you know, going into, you know, 9,000 reservists, going into Gaza, causing an incursion. I mean, what are you really doing? A lot of people in Gaza know how to shoot a weapon. A lot of people in Gaza are armed. So you need the power of numbers. You need the power of infantry. And a lot of these resistance movements are counting on the power of numbers to offset the infantry power. And they're not only doing it with missiles and infantry, they're also doing it in terms of drone technology. You know, a very important component in the asymmetrical warfare is to create confusion in the airspace, whereby, you know, you have all these different drones swarming around, and sure, you can have as many F-14s and F-16s and, you know, joint strike fighters to, you know, try and dominate the sky. But a lot of them carry different forms of, you know, types of technology. A lot of them have a sophisticated tracking and stealth. You know, that go with them. And that, you know, that becomes also an offset. When we talk about precision guided munitions, for example, these are very important for the resistance. Utilizing them, refining them, you know, creating, you know, commencing a technology that goes, that's much more accurate. You know, Iran during the 1990s had into the 2000s had an accuracy of 30 meters with its missiles. It's now towards the 15 meters accuracy, very accurate missiles. And, you know, this is done in a process of learning by doing. And each country, each resistance movement has the obligation to create its own skilled workforce that knows all of its experts, that know how to do these things, how to, you know, organize logistically, operationally, strategically, tactically on different levels to create this deterrence in various areas of warfare. You cannot just focus on missiles alone, even though that is a very important deterrence factor. You need those powers of numbers. You need the drone warfare. You need to go along with this integrated IT military system that is now pretty much standard in warfare.
Right, so which then makes you wonder, right? Like, where are we at in terms of the history of military technology vis-a-vis economic power, right? Because we would think mm-hmm. that the big economic powers have the big military power, right? But like, yep. that calculus is dumb. That's like 19th century thinking. That's me thinking that yes. like, oh, look at these naval ships belonging to the Brits. They're big, big fucking swinging dicks, man. But like, it's meaningless now. Like, those ships are ancient, like aircraft carriers, like all those frigates and stuff, like destroyers. Like, Hezbollah hit one in 2006. I mean, apparently, there was no countermeasures. But like, whatever. What are you gonna do to stop a fucking incoming missile? This is a reminder that war is a business. First of all, right?
And absolutely.
Like, anybody yeah. who's been in like a large university, which is also a business, will also know that these businesses are inefficient, that their first goal is to create capital, or at least to sort of line the pockets of the people who own the different industries, right? So
yep.
build all the fucking F-35s that you want. Like, it costs, apparently every time the F-35 needs to fly, that it has to be repainted. And it costs like $4 million or something every single
yes,
time.
Yes, I heard
like,
that.
This is a racket. War is a business in the West. So like, don't confuse that with power, right? Like, don't confuse.
Absolutely, very true.
Like, this is this is something that we are watching right now unfold in Palestine, right? Because what makes the Zionists strong, what makes the sort of Israel strong is the sort of ideology, the sort of image of itself, the IDF, which is to say, is, and which is interlinked profoundly with the ideology of Zionism, of settler colonialism, which is we set the terms of how we encounter the native, right? We have the power, we have the force, and we are the ones who control the theater. But that's not true anymore. Like, that is not true.
Exactly.
It has not been true since 2006. Right? Like, that is, we are now watching a huge, hugely important transformation in the balance of power, in the terms of engagement, like however you want to call it, right? The albeit fairly unsophisticated rocketry and missile technology of the Palestinian resistance, which is precisely why, like, they have to keep Gaza under blockade for over a decade, because if you, God forbid, mm-hmm. you open them up to the world, they're going to get even stronger faster. Right, so you have to like retard yep. their development, which is the same reason they keep us besieged in Iran. But it didn't matter anyways, because we have a lot of resources, like we have a lot of people. Like, this is not, you know, that didn't stop our program. Actually, we should probably talk about Mokaddam himself, because he's an interesting character. Mm-hmm. And because where does he come from? What's his story? What's his kind of trajectory? Because we're kind of we're watching a kind of flowering of his strategy. Unfold, not his strategy per se, but his hands are kind of behind this moment.
Yeah, absolutely. I think he was a very important figure in Iran's missile development program. He's also referred to as the father of Iran's missile program. And he was a very intelligent lone individual who was very curious. He was very intelligent. And he was basically, Tehrani Mokaddam was the man who turned the IRGC's military force from something of an embryonic unit, you know, starting it basically from scratch, to a major branch of service, where, you know, now it's part of the aerospace force led by Hajizadeh. And, you know, initially, Tehrani Mokaddam was one of the many youths who was confronted with the Iraqi invasion of Iran, right? And he was an engineer. And the first thing that came to his mind and to the mind of his colleagues was to reverse engineer the missiles that were already either owned by Iran or that had the potency to attack, to reciprocate an Iraqi attack, right? We talked about the War of Cities, how this War of Cities had an effect on the Iranian populace. And Tehrani Mokaddam really tried to reciprocate and answer those attacks. you know, in order to deter the Iraqi invasion. So he started with reverse engineering a Soviet-era Scud missile, the Scud-B, and he basically designed, the very first time it was reverse engineered, you know, it took a lot of effort because, you know, like I said, Gaddafi wasn't willing to fire the weapons against his Arab brothers and, you know, needed a lot of technical knowledge from the Syrians eventually, you know, because Tehrani Moqaddam went to Syria, he went to North Korea. He acquired the knowledge there to create the first Shahab-1 missile, which is one of the most important revolutions in terms of missile technology in order to attack an Iraqi military infrastructure. And that was very much the foundation of Iran's missile program. You know, it had, you know, the Scud-B, the Soviet-era Scud-B, you know, was designed, I think, around the late period of right after the decade after World War II. So it was an old Soviet-era Scud, but it had a range of 300 kilometers. But at that point, you know, they kind of launched it very closely to the Iraqi border. It was a horrible logistical nightmare. You know, it was scary, close to the Iraqi border, but they succeeded. And with that success, you know, in the years thereafter, Iran not only created the Shahab-1, but also introduced the Shahab-3 with a 2,000-kilometer radius. And this was in the mid-1990s. So in a very short, relatively short period of a decade or two, Iran, you know, goes from a 300-kilometer copy Scud missile from, you know, designed after World War II to a 2,000-kilometer Shahab-3 missile, medium-range ballistic missile. And a lot of this Shahab-3 was adopted from the North Koreans, which Iran is very thankful for. You know, the North Korean Nodong, I think, was a very important inspiration to develop the Shahab-3 with the 2,000-kilometer range. And even afterwards, you know, Tehrani Moqaddam was a very curious person. He knew that the medium range and the short range Scud wasn't necessarily a weapon that we should be satisfied with, certainly not during the war and thereafter. And so he created this missile force, you know, as a branch of service and slowly developed other missiles, which became much more reliable. You know, the Nodong, the North Korean Shahab-3, you know, the Shahab-3 was modeled after the North Korean Nodong-1. It lacked reliability. It lacked precision. You know, these ranges of 2,000 kilometer are very shady, are very difficult to, you know, precisely assess their accuracy, their validity, the projection that they have in terms of effectiveness. And you see that Iran starts looking for, you know, increased skill sets, you know, situation whereby they look at wind tunnels, developing wind tunnels, developing high-grade alloys, improving its engines, improving its stealth technology. So a lot of different things, you know, from the 1990s, and this is a very important period for Iran. That's when you see that when we talk about revolution in military affairs for the Soviet Union, the United States, it started with the arms and space race. For Iran, during the 1990s, that was the period where it really got into the revolution of military affairs. And of course, as you mentioned, you know, and Hassan Abbasi, one of the Iranian political theorists in Iran, is asked this question very often. So why don't we buy these prestigious ships and aircraft? Why don't we just buy them or, you know, invest in them? And Hassan Abbasi is very clear. He says, look, we have to have, I mean, you know, the amount of money that you spend on these ships and aircraft, you can spend on creating logistics, research and development. You know, you can create these wind tunnels, you can create this stealth technology, you can assist resistance movements, empower them with very small resources, very scarce resources. You don't need too much investment to really empower the people that want to be empowered. So that is Iran's, you know, strategy in terms of military development. Not keeping the knowledge to yourself, but making sure that the different allies that you have, the different resistance movements who are trying to create a counterbalance to hegemony, have the capacity, the capabilities and the knowledge, the skill set to develop their own missile programs, their own knowledge, their own asymmetrical warfare, their own wind tunnels and so forth. And so, you know, at the end of 1997, you see that Iran announces the Shahab-4. So this is a more refined version of the Nodong missile with an increased range between 2,000 and 4,000 kilometers. So, you know, you keep on seeing much more precision-guided missiles. You see much more research and development. And you really see Iran investing in areas where it can really offer a deterrence vis-a-vis, you know, these corporations and all these military manufacturers in the West, which are appealing and lobbying in terms of the prestige of a country and trying to create an image that isn't necessarily effective, isn't necessarily potent in the battlefield. You mentioned the United Kingdom. You know, the United Kingdom is very much fixated with its, you know, ancient idea of being a maritime power. So it has all these ships and all these, you know, stealthy looking, boats. But essentially what it's, if you really look at the missile capability that Iran has, you know, one of these missiles hitting a ship like that that costs, you know, millions of dollars is, you know, it's just not comparable. And it's not worth the investment if you look at it from a warfare perspective. So these are very big differences. And Iran, you know, in terms of also its capability as an economic power, seems to be just doing the right thing, doing what is necessary to survive and to grow, develop into something, you know, much more efficient.
Right. And think about the North Korean case. Right, like and this is something I sort of began articulating on the last question, but of course my mind raced ahead of me, which is like, what makes like sort of the U.S. global alliance or the countries like, say, South Korea, the Republic of Korea, so strong? Like, what does it make it? It's a powerful economic force. Sure, it's got a lot of people. It's got this alliance with the U.S. Same thing with Israel, right? Like, same thing. It's a small country, albeit population-wise. And, you know, a huge part of that population is subjugated. So their talents are suppressed and whatever. So like initially, like they don't even use their entire manpower, which is its own kind of indictment of Zionism. But like racism is so important to Zionism that it doesn't use the talents of the sort of Arab indigenous people that lived there before them. But that's a different sort of issue altogether.
Yeah.
But like, if you think about like what makes Israel a strong country is also what makes it a weak country. Like its technology, its industrial production, the fact that it relies on ports and shipping for so much of its imports, right? That it can't, because of its policies, because of its absolutely terrible sort of brutality to its neighbors, who's going to trade with it, right? So you have to have everybody in the world bring you stuff, right? Which makes you vulnerable, right? Which makes your economy vulnerable.
Absolutely.
Right? Palestinians can survive besieged, no problem. You can tear down their houses. You can bulldoze their apartments. It's shocking. It's terrible. People die, but they will survive. Right? Can you really say that about the Israeli economy? Can you really think that, like, who's going to harvest their vegetables? Who's going to, all those expensive greenhouses full of tomatoes, who's going to harvest those? Who's going to go there? Right? Like, the resistance in Palestine has achieved a deterrent force. The political leaders of Israel and the military leaders of Israel won't ever admit it, but that's what we're watching now, which is so incredible, right? They've achieved something that North Korea has achieved, in the sense, same thing that Iran has achieved, which
absolutely.
Is instructing your enemy that it will cost you dearly if you come at us, right? And what's interesting about the Iranian case study, I mean, I was watching this documentary on Mogadam, right? Like this. Like the Iran-Iraq war, right? The Iraq invasion, right, was a kind of trial by fire for the Islamic Republic. It created an entire generation of foot soldiers, of heroes, of scientists, of, you know, doctors, whatever, right? It sort of birthed the society we're in now. And one of those things was, as you explained, this sort of turn towards missiles, right? And it's also funny that like this
Absolutely.
Happens, like, it's so funny, like world history is changing while Hollywood, of course, is making Top Gun, right? Which is this, which to this day, you still see Top Gun posters in like places like, you see in places like hobby shops, like those weird hobby, you know, whatever, like those, you always see tanks and planes, all those like sexy military things that like men fetishize, like certain class of men.
Absolutely.
It's just meaningless. You think they're going to make a rocket, a model rocket? Like it would look so fucking stupid, right? But like, it's not romantic, a missile, the way that like a tank is to a certain kind of brain, right? But the reality is that like these have resulted in a massive, massive political accomplishment for the actors employing this technology that like we're watching right now. Like this is, I keep saying this over and over again, but like this is revolutionary what's happening. What we're watching Absolutely. Unfold before our eyes, as terrible it is, is historic moment. I mean, I just keep saying over again, but like think about the North Koreans, for example, right? Like if anything was threatened at them, they have an ICBM, right? That could land in Washington, right? With a nuclear mm-hmm. warhead, mm-hmm. right? Like that's like,
yeah,
that like they that's have their, collapsed the distance. They've rendered the American military machine meaningless. So all they can do is huff and puff and make fun of Kim Jong-un and make racist jokes and racist movies like The Interview. And even then, that exactly. cost them dearly. Ask Sony what that movie cost them, right? Like this
that was
is
a horrible movie too.
I never watched it. I should do an episode on it, but it's so utterly racist the way people dismiss North Koreans. But, but the thing is, the US created its own enemies in this almost like Hegelian way. It forged its own enemies that rendered it neutralized its power, right? So like by destroying like 20% of the North Korean population in the so-called Korea War, right, which was a war of fucking partition, imperial partition, they enraged generations of people and emboldened that leader and his son later to create, and grandson too, actually, is that to continue this policy, this upping of military strength. And they will never go near Absolutely. North Korea, ever. Never in their wildest dreams, right?
Absolutely. I
mean, it's just,
you
it's
mentioned,
so funny.
You mentioned a very good point. You know, when you talk about, you know, an entity like Israel, when you talk about South Korea, for example, you know, South Korea was one of the major Asian tigers in the global economy, right? It was, these countries embraced globalization, embraced capitalism, but that also came with a cost, namely that if you embrace this interconnected world that is, you know, governed by a preeminent U.S. superpower, you're also very much dependent. And the South Koreans, it's very interesting you mentioned this, the South Koreans wanted to manufacture their own aircraft, their attack aircraft. They wanted to have the same sort of fourth generation aircraft that the United States has. But as what Iran is facing currently, because that's also what's kind of stalling the Iranian development in terms of aircraft development and you know, fighter aircraft, is that the South Koreans realize that the United States is not giving them the technology they need to manufacture a fighter aircraft. What they realize is that, okay, you can create an engine, you can create a physical aircraft, but you also need the correlation between software and hardware to correctly work. And a lot of the technology the South Koreans didn't have, and despite being dependent on the US dollar, the US economic financial system, the US supremacy, US support in its region, it would not give these sensitive technologies to a country like South Korea. So you're always dependent. You're always, you know, holding out your hand to a superpower. You're always hoping that they're going to save you, that they're going to, you know, inject capital into your economy, that they're going to print more fiat currency to help you. And eventually you're going to find out that this is not worth it. And I think a lot of the populace in South Korea realize this. I think a lot of the people in Japan realize this. And certainly not that their leadership is you know, really has any spine. You know, you end up becoming this paper tiger. You know, a lot of the resistance movement call the Zionist regime a paper tiger. You know, that's exactly because it's a lot of bolstering, a lot of bragging about this prowess, about, you know, the U.S. makes countless TV shows about the Mossad and how invincible it is, and how the military is invincible. And then you gotta start fighting against a bunch, what you would call a ragtag militia of a couple of jihadis, and you just cannot sustain this war. You cannot win this war. It's impossible. And even worse, your own citizens are suffering. Your own citizens are not seeing the benefits, the added benefits of all of this investment, all of these billions of dollars that the U.S. is injecting militarily in countries like South Korea, in countries like in countries like Saudi Arabia, and in our region.
I mean, they created Saudi Arabia as like this, as this kind of banking hub and a place to sort of put their naval forces, whatever. Have a nice pliant family in charge of it, and now those guys are their biggest purchasers of weapons, right? Like, this is the dream scenario for imperialists. Total, like, the fiction of independence while masking the absolute dependence on the most garbage civilization of, so garbage sort of ideation of modernity you've ever seen, right? So it's copying
absolutely
garbage Brits and American society in terms of its military thinking, whatever, and going forward. Meanwhile, they couldn't even overpower Yemen, literally one of the poorest countries in the world, right? Like, they had their asses handed them.
Yes,
they had their asses handed to them, and you know they of course they copied the Americans too. They gave it a nice resounding operation something. It was the most corny shit you've ever seen, you know. And what did they do? They only humiliated themselves, bled themselves poor, kept war going. It's a racket. Like, this war is a racket, and the countries that develop weapons, countries like North Korea, countries like Iran, they develop weapons as defensive, right? That's the thing. Exactly. Whereas the U.S. doesn't defend against anything. The U.S. is an empire. It goes out and extends its power, right? The U.S. military is the largest polluter on the planet. It's costing our planet something. Forget its crimes. I mean, it's just no very words. True. I have no words. I mean,
I think we really need to take a cue from the Soviet Union. You know, during the Soviet Union, there was an ongoing debate, right, about what is more efficient, what is more effective in terms of creating a military industrial complex, right? A military that really creates weaponry, invents weaponry creatively, develops its own industrial complex with the capabilities it has. You know, how do we make sure that the right money goes to the right requirements in terms of military capability? And the Soviets really realized that you can't have this, you know, these private enterprises creating all these weapons for you and lobbying on your behalf. That's not the effective and efficient way to do it. You need the state to have control over key sectors of your economy and in your military sector. So when we talk about the Soviet Union, and I think Iran made a very wise decision not to privatize this military industrial in the way that we see in these capitalist countries, where you see this a lot of tit for tatting and a lot of co-optation, bribery taking place in these capitalist countries when we talk about military developments. In Iran's case, Iran's missile defense capability is determined in large part by state-owned enterprises. These are government-owned enterprises that do not look towards a profit, do not look towards prowess, do not look towards an image, but are very much focused on how can we get the best result for the best buck. And that is a major difference between free countries like Syria, Iran, Palestinian territories, you know, different countries around the world, North Korea, and the capitalist world, which is a very different dynamic and very much focused on the corporate world and the state-society complex that evolves around it. And that's when you also see the different debates in public, where you don't see a debate in public really in the United States or in Saudi Arabia or in South Korea about what expenditures the government should have. The ordinary people in Iran, for example, have these debates with politicians almost on a daily basis. There is always the discussion in Iran. Iran has a self-imposed 2,000-kilometer range for its missile program. This range was determined by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei. There is ongoing debate in every political echelon in Iran, including the members of the Supreme Security Council in the Islamic Republic, whether we should extend the 2,000-kilometer range. Do we want to have a strategic missile capability that strikes not the enemy up close in, you know, vassal states, but do we want to reach Europe? Do we want to reach the United States like the North Koreans have? It's a very vibrant discussion going on. The same goes for the nuclear weapons capability. Right now, Iran is determined by, you know, the fatwa of the leader of the Islamic Revolution not to support any kind of development in nuclear weapons. But as many other politicians have also alluded to, there is the possibility that Iran, if Iran is placed in a corner whereby countries that are armed to the teeth with nuclear weapons are trying to create a situation whereby Iran could be attacked with nuclear weapons. You know, Hillary Clinton during 2009 said, "We will obliterate Iran." I mean, what are you referring to with when you say obliterate? You're talking about a nuclear weapons capability. These discussions are taking place in the political domain, in the public domain, and, you know, strategic capability is very important. So you don't need a nuclear weapon but you do want a strategic capability to reach every city in the world with the ballistic missiles, with the accuracy that you've developed. And that's not a debate you see in political echelons in Saudi Arabia or South Korea. These are compliant regimes that do exactly what they're told and have no, you know, they give the idea of an ordinary country, of a country with sovereignty. You know, they're members of the United Nations. But essentially what you notice very quickly is that the countries who value sovereignty, who value their future, who value the effectiveness of their defense capabilities, incorporate political voices, incorporate public voices in their development.
That's a good place to end it on, Ash. Thank you very much. Can you tell us where to find you? Tell us what to look for?
You can find me on Twitter pretty much. IR Military Vlog is my handle. And yeah, you can find me on YouTube. I still have some vlogs there, Iran Military Vlog. And of course, I try to do the podcast, but you know, I've been all on vacation, which is the New Asian Century podcast. You can find that on Twitter as well.
Thank you, Arash.
Thank you so much, Sinan.